Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrats Dan Johnson and David Lundy, and Republicans Stephanie Hitt and Anthony Anderson. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. We've got 2 hours talking primarily politics, not too much about issues, although we will have some conversation about the issue in Benghazi, the tragedy in Benghazi, and whether or not that will really have a significant impact on shifting any votes. Certainly it's something that the campaigns and the national media have talked about, but we're going to find out whether it is shifting any votes. But we're going to look at the bigger, broader picture of how the campaigns stand with 2 weeks to go. And joining us we have a great panel tonight, and the news that has dominated for the last 48 hours has been the weather and Hurricane Sandy and what its impact will be when it hits the East Coast of the United States. And Dan Johnson, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having
me. And I want to get your reaction about weather and whether or not this is going to have any significant impact.
I mean, the one obvious one is that it depresses the early vote operation because people have to stay home. But the bigger picture, I think, is that when after a summer of drought, the hottest year on record, this massive Franken once-in-a-100-year storm that hits, I think people are starting to think this climate change thing is happening. And the people that keep denying it are out of touch. And I think much like a little wave coming up from under the surface.
You see it as a wave that the Democrats can sort of spin it for climate change.
Well,
as opposed to someone, let's say, from the evangelical right that might say this is God's will to depress the vote in areas where the president might do well.
I'd imagine Pat Buchanan's already saying that. Right? Didn't he say we're here to punish New Orleans because they were a den of iniquity?
There are people that believe that. Stephanie,
that's right.
Is one of our Republicans. What's your reaction, Stephanie?
You know, to be honest, I think if this were happening a week later, I think this would be a really serious discussion that we're having. But my thought is this, and that is even if there's snow that accompanies this, that most of any damage or any difficulties will be long gone by then, and people will be shoveled out. And you're right, you know, it may affect some of the early voting, but it may also encourage some people to early vote before the storm hits. But
well, is it also going to be an opportunity to measure what role FEMA or other federal agencies are going to have in dealing with this?
You get
David?
To close this election out with the president looking presidential. So he gets to be in the White House. He gets to be you better believe you're going to see the president in the Situation Room managing this
with
crisis.
With his jacket with a little seal on it.
Exactly. I think that from a political perspective, you know, you're keeping the president off the campaign trail. Mitt Romney's going to be under some pressure to stay off of the campaign trail in certain states. But frankly, that could help him by pushing him into states where it might have a greater impact, like Wisconsin. But the one thing I want to say is, since this election really comes down to Ohio, you know, the question is, did the early vote of the Obama operation, did they rack up enough early vote to really make a difference? Because what I'm hearing is that this storm the effects may not be gone by the time of the election. And in fact, if this doesn't hit the shore until Monday, Tuesday, and this is a 1,000-mile-long storm, I was just talking to a friend on Long Island on my way down here, and he said, we're expecting we could have no power for up to 7 to 10 days.
But early voting is generally regarded by the experts as something that could be bipartisan, whereas absentee voting is an overwhelming edge to the Republicans. And by the way, we should say that we do this program from the Museum of Broadcast Communications, and literally 35 feet from where I'm sitting right now, we are an early voting site, not the Beyond the Beltway show, but Museum of Broadcast Communications. And they have had record turnouts every single day. By the way, for those living in Chicago, you've got one more week until this Saturday. Anthony Anderson.
One of the things that concerns me the most is the fact, like you were stating earlier, is that you have over 10 states in this country, from Virginia to Massachusetts, that have declared emergency states of emergency, and that's going to affect 60 million people. You know, and a week before the election, that sort of concerns me a lot. And in fact, like you stated earlier, early voting has been a big success in Illinois. I think at this point, there's been up to 100,000 plus people doing early voting in the state of Illinois alone.
Yeah.
Alone. And so, you know, if you have 60 million people that may or may not be disenfranchised, I mean, we could see this whole election back in the courts again, because
some people are going to want
to say, hey, listen, we were affected by an unnatural disaster, and so therefore we feel that we may be slighted if we don't have a chance to vote. This storm is going to hit Tuesday.
Oh, please.
And people are preparing for it Monday.
Here.
It could be 08 all over again if people get disenfranchised from a natural disaster. That's all I'm saying.
Does anybody agree with that, Dan?
I am an election lawyer, and I
know that in real life.
In real life, right. And I'm afraid there isn't a cause of action against a natural disaster. You can't put God in federal court for saying you caused a hurricane.
But you don't think that some people may feel slighted if they don't have an opportunity?
Sure. Absolutely.
We're talking about 60 million people in 10 different states.
Look, but people who feel
prior to the national election,
people,
I mean,
but people who
somebody
feel
has
slighted,
to say something.
People who feel slighted and people who have legal action are two separate things.
But
from political, let's follow up on Anthony's point. From a political standpoint, Stephanie, wouldn't that help Romney? I mean, if there are people and it's difficult for them to get to the polls on the Eastern Seaboard, most of those states are going, with the exception of Virginia, which may be in play. All those states are Obama states.
Yeah, they are. And you know, it's funny because if we want to look at it just in the battleground perspective, we're really only looking at Virginia and New Hampshire. Those are the battleground states
that will be
affected. And
Pennsylvania.
And Pennsylvania, because we can start to say that may be in play. Certainly the eastern part of that state has that risk.
Which is the Democratic side.
You have to start to look at what are the preparations that these boards of elections have, because if the power is out for a significant amount of time, are they going to be setting up makeshift polling sites with handwritten ballots, and will the computer systems
be working?
There
should be no discussion of postponing the election.
Bruce's point, I think it does. I mean, voter suppression is part of Mitt Romney's playbook, part of Republican legislatures.
There's no playbook that says that.
Clear. Look at the war on voting.
Oh, please.
Part of the reason we talked about early voting is because Republican legislatures have been shrinking the days where you can cast an early vote, have been putting voter ID requirements. It's part and parts of the last 2 years.
It's what the Speaker of the
Go ahead.
The President of the United States of America came to town in Chicago just this week to do early voting. The first thing
he did it at the end, and he should have.
And I'll go on record criticizing the president for not voting.
The first thing they asked the most powerful man on the face of the planet is, "We need to see your ID."
And he didn't. That's not what Illinois law allows for. So he shouldn't have been asked for that.
If the president of the United States can give up his state ID, then truly it shouldn't be a problem for anybody else in this country.
Didn't ask for his birth certificate.
Right. Didn't ask for his birth certificate. Ask for a driver's license.
1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Duman. We're off to a fast start in Chicago tonight. Bruce Duman back in Chicago to clarify a point that if you are voting in Chicago and Illinois, if it's early voting where you have to show your photo ID, but for Election Day, you do not have to do that. You have to be registered. So we want to clarify that. Let's head to telephone calls. We've already got people on the line. We've got a call from Ohio. Everybody wants to hear what Ohio is up to. Steve, go ahead. Calling from Ashtabula, listening to us on WKBN.
Yes, sir. How are you doing tonight?
Yeah, fine. And yourself?
Good. I wanted to make the case for Obama, if I could.
Yes.
Especially for Ohio. Everybody knows now that northeastern Ohio is really starting to recover. And a lot of it has to do with the auto industry. The fact that Obama did it immediately, didn't screw around with it, got him right back to work. Not just Ohio, but Michigan, obviously, and the rest of the country. And even the – I really want to make a – I think what I would call a small business pitch for Ohioans, you know, what Obama is doing, including the Affordable Care Act, which as soon as we get back into recovery mode is going to have dividends for small business. You'll know that your employees got health care, if you can afford it or not, you the company, that is. Labor, of course, will have the portability. You know, they'll have a little more leverage with capital to get a little
Steve,
bit more money.
Let me cut you off and just get to some broader issues. I want to get everybody's reaction to what you had to say. Let me repeat or summarize something that was said several months ago on this program by Bertram D'Souza, who is with the Vindicator in Youngstown, Ohio. And this was during a discussion of the campaign many, many months ago. And it was suggested that although the bailout included the Lordstown plant, which is a significant employer in your neck of the woods, that Obama wasn't as popular there, and he suggested or implied that perhaps there was a racial issue that was going on here. Do you sense there is any of that in the discussions that you may have had? And secondly, is the bigger issue here that Mitt Romney has not been able to connect with some working class white men who normally would be voting Republican?
Why would he? I mean, here's the guy. He's made his whole career on telling American workers, you have to accept much fewer, less wages for your work, or we're going to ship your work to brand new factories in China. Why would they vote for this guy?
Well, because a lot of white males are doing that. Stephanie, your reaction?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I hear you talking about the recovery with the auto industry. Remember the original idea even to offer GM significant help. It actually came from George Bush. It didn't come from Obama. And in addition, when Obama did step in, there were significant rule of law issues that came up when he subordinated the rights of true creditors under law for those rights of the government. So, I mean, part of it is, you know, Obama's trying to get all this credit for these bailouts when, in fact, you know, a lot of the work that had been done for that was done by a prior administration. And in addition, I just want to, the second part is, and this is, I'm going to ask the caller this question, and that is, okay, and we can discuss this here, is we are seeing in places like Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin, there are the tightening of the polls and this talk about a recovery, but we are talking about states that got hit very hard in the manufacturing but have Republican governors who have policies in place involving reducing the taxes on small businesses, promoting growth, promoting jobs.
All of those things are true, but all in those cases, and this is something we discussed about 2 years ago on this program, and that is that when you have a governor, and in this particular case, one of the big stories of the recent cycle was the return of Republican governors in America's heartland.
Yeah.
When you have a governor who's in charge, again, Illinois is a different state because it elected a Democrat, but you make changes. So Governor Kasich and the governors in Wisconsin and these other states, they've ticked a lot of people off, including Scott Walker in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So because you're a governor doing what you think is good for the state, and maybe that state is showing some degree of recovery, that sort of flies in the face of at least what Romney is saying. Dave Lundy.
You know, Bruce, I love how Republicans like to spin the bailout these days. We hate bailouts. Bailouts are terrible. Bailouts are terrible. Well, Barack Obama, you can't claim credit because that one worked. It was actually George Bush who was responsible. I mean, like, give me a break. Barack Obama may not have been the originator of the auto bailout, but he certainly was the executioner of the auto bailout, including some of the rule changes that Republicans go crazy over. The fact is it has been enormously successful. The fact is that without that bailout, Ohio would not have had as strong of an economic recovery as it did. And as much as Republicans—
Do you believe that Michigan then, because there's a suggestion that Michigan may be in play.
No, there may be an opportunity there. I've seen those polls. I know that's a suggestion.
I'm not making this stuff up.
No. You're not suggesting it. Yeah. I've read the suggestion. I think it's a fantasy. And I think that if Mitt Romney really believed that Michigan was in play, he'd be investing a lot of money there and in Pennsylvania, and they haven't lifted a finger.
I heard two things I heard. One of the Obama speeches, he said, you know, one out of six jobs in Ohio is connected to the auto industry. And I didn't realize that. I didn't realize how much the auto industry had sort of moved south from Michigan. And when I thought, look, once Mitt Romney became the nominee, Michigan's off the table. You can't be so hostile to automobile manufacturing and expect folks to vote for you. I didn't know that that impacted Ohio so much. The second one I wanted to make is I don't know that it's racial so much. I think it's fascinating that there are a lot of people that say, you know, I just don't like government. I don't like the idea of bailouts, but I sure like it when I get a check from my insurance company because the Affordable Care Act requires me to get a refund. And I sure like it when I have a job at a manufacturing
plant. Or I like when FEMA shows up in the wake of a hurricane.
And so I think that's the fascinating thing about, undecided, I don't know, white working class voters, people that have this idea that I just like limited government, but gee, the Democratic administration's working for me, and I don't know how to resolve that.
Well, I can agree, but the bailouts were certainly needed. And that goes without saying. The bailouts were needed for these GM and all the other companies that received them. But the fact of the matter is, it's how the bailouts were implemented. Now, yes, GM got the bailout. Yes, Romney was for bailout of these different auto companies. But the fact of the matter is, first, he wanted to make sure that the people that benefited the most were not the public, not the unions. And in this instance, and in this case, we all know that the people who benefited the most, even over the shareholders, were those in the union. And that's where the rub is coming in. It's not like we disagree with having a bailout. It's the fact that the unions get so much more than the average investor.
I have a cultural question. I have a cultural question. Is one of the reasons why, allegedly, everything is allegedly now, because we're going to let the people vote, actually, very soon.
Data.
They won't have to, they won, they lost.
No polling, actual votes. Yeah.
But
thank God.
How much of it is cultural? How much of it is that he looks the way he looks, he was bred the way he was bred? He doesn't smoke, he doesn't drink, he doesn't swear, he doesn't play around. He's not the guy you're going to go out and have a beer with.
You know, I disagree on that. I think, you know, the Republic, Obama and the Democrats want to paint him as the most out of touch, unrelatable person that you can out there. And I think when people saw him for real in the debates, unscripted, unfiltered, not in somebody's ad, not misportrayed, they saw that this is a real person who gets a real sense of how people may have struggles, the day-to-day issues in everybody's life. And
I'm talking about the cultural stuff. I'm talking about, and, you know, would you want to go to a ball game with this guy?
Let's talk about Obama's culture. He's too good for me.
What's the story?
You know,
what do you think?
Me personally, I do believe Romney is sincere in his beliefs.
And which ones?
I agree with that. The ones that he's articulated in the last two debates.
Most recently.
Which is the moderate Mitt, and that's what's driving the Democrats crazy and the president's crazy because, oh my God, this guy is really a moderate.
He's really acting as a moderate.
It seems though the more Romney was exposed to the camera, the more sincere, the more humanistic people see him as being, as opposed to what the Democrats paint him in these ads. That's the truth. The fact of the matter is more people, even the women vote, got a huge bump. And so they saw that this man, maybe he's not this person that's being portrayed in the media.
David Lundy.
That is not why. It is because he reinvented himself again as this character, and he disavowed positions he's taken for 2 years.
And his polls are going up.
Right.
And his polls went up in response.
So what does it tell you? What do we know? Stop the presses here. Stop the presses. I'm going to say something startling. And you mean he's acting like a politician?
No, he's
saying what needs to be said to get a vote.
But so you know what? In other words,
it's sort of like Barack Obama running in the Democratic primary 4 years ago when he was going to close Guantanamo and he was going to do all the things because he's solidifying the left of the Democratic
not
Party
the
in
same.
A campaign against
not
Hillary Clinton.
You'll acknowledge. Well, it's two things.
Well, what is the difference?
The difference.
What is the difference in what I've just said?
Because look, every politician has to tack a little bit, right? But Romney takes it to a whole nother level. He flips every election cycle. Where he was as a governor of Massachusetts, just
he said he was going to take us forward.
He said he was going to etch a sketch.
He etch a sketch. And he etched a sketch. That's right. I'm going to let you respond. We're about to go to a break. No one's going to hear anything you say. 29 is the telephone number. We're talking about bailouts. We're talking about everything else. I understand there's another request. More bailout has been asked for from the state of Michigan. It's coming from the Detroit Tigers. I don't think we're going to do it. From Minnetonka to Miami Beach, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's great radio stations and also Sirius XM satellite radio. Also joining us this evening, we have Dave Lundy. Dave Lundy is a Democrat, and he is the president of Aileron Communications. Anthony Anderson is our Republican. He's with the Illinois Republican Precinct Project. Dan Johnson joins us. He is an attorney in private practice and also has a new company called
Equity Partner Match.
EquityPartnerMatch.com. All right. We want to get the .com in there.
I appreciate it.
And Stephanie Hitt joins us. She is a Republican. She is a former attorney. I guess you're still an attorney, but you're a housewife and mother, and your daughter's come here to watch your mother perform on the air tonight.
That's right.
You're doing a wonderful job. 1-800-723-8029. Let's go to Manuka, Illinois. Glenn is listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Bruce. I just wanted to tell you a little story that happened to me. This was just, I think, Wednesday last week. I went to vote early out at the Grundy County Courthouse, and the first names that come up to be voted on, of course, are Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. Obama's at the top, and these are touchscreen voting machines, by the way.
Yes, that's what I voted on.
And right underneath Obama, of course, there's Mitt Romney. Now, I clearly went to touch the name Mitt Romney on the touchscreen, and I'm looking at the screen, and the vote comes up registered as a vote for Barack Obama. I'm like, what's going on? So I called the election judges in, and they came in, and we corrected the vote. And I've heard this two other times now where this situation has occurred. In fact, someone called in and was talking to Sean Hannity on the radio just a couple nights ago. Said the same thing happened to her. So I'm just putting the word out that people need to be very careful when they're
Well,
going
also,
to vote
Glenn,
for
it's
president.
It's very important. Again, this may be an isolated incident, but it's always good, and at least in the voting machines that we use in Chicago, you do at the very end of the process, there is a paper that you actually can look at, which is why the lighting has got to be good in the polling place, so that you can look, because you literally sign off on a piece of paper, and you've got to make sure that everything is matched. So it seems to me that they've built into the system something that should give the voter intention is real accurate. But again, that it's a good point. And it was the first time I voted, you know, the touchscreen, and it was easy to follow. Let me ask you, thanks very much for your calling. Let me broaden the question out. In some of these states where it is, very, very close, and that appears to at least be, you know, maybe 8 to 10 states, maybe even more. What about Gary Johnson and other third-party candidates?
Yeah.
Dan, could that tip some of those states to Obama or certainly it would it could tip over the apple cart.
Yeah, look, I mean, Gary Johnson is the Libertarian candidate. Virgil Good, Gary Johnson, former governor of New Mexico, is the Libertarian candidate, Republican governor of New Mexico. Virgil Good, former Republican congressman, is on the ballot in Virginia as the nominee of the Constitution Party.
Right.
Jill Stein is the nominee of the Green Party. I actually think Virginia is the one where Virgil Good may be the tipping factor, because he's got name recognition. He has some popularity among a lot of folks who voted for him.
What about Gary Johnson in Colorado?
I think that's.
And by the way, the poll I saw that he had 4% in Ohio.
I think he's.
I was shocked.
Yeah,
by that.
You know, I think Gary Johnson's probably leading the pack among the third party folks, with the exception of maybe Virgil Good just in Virginia. But you know, he was a very, very popular governor, won twice. And I think for those libertarian, Ron Paul-minded Republicans who feel they got railroaded at Tampa, that the establishment, Mitt Romney, never spoke for them, I think a lot of them may feel like, you know what, I'm going to vote for Gary Johnson and send my message, particularly in the West.
Anthony, your reaction to that?
Well, he may be onto something here. I mean, yeah, this may be a good protest vote simply because most people feel in certain states that they were slighted. They never got an opportunity to pick the person who they wanted to run as president of the United States.
Right.
And this may be that instance where it won't rise to the level of, you know, Ross Perot levels, you know, when he ran and took the vote.
It doesn't have to.
Yeah, it doesn't have to. All it takes is a percentage.
If you get 4% or less in Ohio, that's a lot.
Ralph Nader.
Absolutely. That could mean the turning point in that state for Mitt Romney, and that may be the reason why he goes down.
I'd be curious about from Ron Paul listeners. You know, I'm sure, I know they're big in talk radio, but because they just were totally railroaded in Tampa, and they
especially residents from the state of Maine. I mean,
I want to hear that. If you're a Ron Paul supporter, or if you're a Gary Johnson supporter, again, give us a call if you're a supporter of anybody. 1-800-723-8289. Stephanie, you're...
Yeah, I think I actually think in those cases, especially in these states where we're talking about 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, that unfortunately a third-party alternative will probably hurt Romney a little bit more because, you know, a lot of voters, this is a referendum on Obama. And so it's just they're not going to vote for Obama.
But
the only way for Romney to win is to get their vote.
But again, in some states and not all states, right. And I don't mean to suggest that legalization of marijuana is the only issue that is of concern to libertarians. But in some states, it would seem to me, and I bring back Colorado, and not that everyone in Colorado is a pothead, because potheads are everywhere. But my question is, it seems to me that in that particular case, it could be hurting President Obama.
Yeah, I actually was going to go
not
there.
Not that all Democrats are potheads either.
Thank you. Yes, I appreciate that.
But there is something about Colorado. Colorado yes. is not Georgia.
No, I actually was going to go there because I actually think Gary Johnson could hurt the president in certain states because of exactly that issue. And Colorado is one of those states. I think Virgil Good in Virginia is a different story, and I think Dan's absolutely right. And Virgil Good could actually cost Mitt Romney the state of Virginia. It's entirely possible. Gary Johnson, I think, can play both ways. Plus, there's an anti-war quality to what Gary Johnson is advocating in the Ron Paul tradition, and so they're not going to like either of the major party nominees.
And again, let me just say what I say every 4 years, that the most important thing that you do when you vote, when you come back home or you go to work, you can look yourself in the mirror and say, I participated and I voted for who I wanted to be president of the United States, not who's leading in the polls, not the way your grandfather necessarily voted or grandmother. Do you feel confident and are you happy that you exercised your right and you voted for the person that you want to lead the free world? And so if you're one of these people that's, you know, out there supporting any of the other candidates and not the big two, go vote and feel good about it and look yourself in the mirror. Let's go to Paul in Austin, Texas, listening to us on KLBJ.
Yes, sir. Hey. I'm a former Ron Paul supporter who looked at Gary Johnson's resume and figured that would not be a bad choice. And I just heard you calling for us to call in, and I am definitely not by myself on this one.
No, I agree. What is it about, is there a specific issue about Gary Johnson that intrigues you the most?
His, what he left New Mexico with like a $1 billion surplus. He was called Governor Vito, as opposed to, you know, just pretty much rolling over to what any special interest wanted. That holds a lot of appeal. He is the only, the only thing in the ballpark of Ron Paul who is going to show up on the ballot. I think Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are just Coke and Pepsi on, you know, pick the issue, how much war, how much regulation, how much. I don't buy anything Romney says about cutting the deficit, cutting, you know, cutting back on the debt. So there you go. That was the only logical choice for me.
Paul, good to have you call in tonight. Let's go to Tim listening to us in Fayetteville, North Carolina. He's listening to us on Sirius Radio tonight. Go ahead.
Hey, sir, I would just like to know, you know, now listening to the debates, you see why both sides are saying they were going to do this for the military. They weren't going to cut this. They were going to cut this. But, you know, we haven't had a raise in the military, but the government workers haven't had a raise like in the last 2 years. It's been a freeze. And, you know, I just want to know which candidate is really going to have our back. Because for me, if Wall Street can get a raise, I think people who protect this country and still work for this country, and especially the retirees and the veterans, we deserve a raise also.
Well, first of all, I mean, caller, you come from a different standpoint. The fact of the matter is the private sector has been getting hit hard since the year 2007. And I think you'll find it hard-pressed for most people to think that federal employees, state employees, municipal employees, no matter what it is, they find it hard-pressed to think that you guys deserve a raise, especially in a climate that we are in today. Seems as though the private sector has lost their underwear pretty much since the year 2007. I mean, you crying for a raise is falling on a deaf ear.
I don't agree. I think No, you're right, of course, because the president has the military's back, whether some folks in the military believe it or not. Because what, to me, the number one question for if you're in military service is, are you going to be put in a war you shouldn't be put into? President Obama has been most...
Talk about wars that you should be put into. I mean, what do you... Could you clarify that statement? I mean...
Sure. Wars that you should Iraq. Be put into. Iraq was a war that we chose, that George Bush chose, okay, on false pretenses, and thousands of Americans died. Thousands of Americans died. Okay, well, you show me the WMD, and we'll talk about it.
When this caller is also calling. I mean, he's talking about government employees.
He's talking about government employees.
I don't
in
think
general.
Most people.
Well, he
view,
said the military.
I don't think most people view people in the military as government employees.
Right.
You know,
supporting
the military, there would be some popular support.
Exactly.
For that. Supporting government employees is, I don't think either party is going to get a lot of, we're going to get a raise because these people are, that's going to do, except in Northern Virginia. It might be doing well there. We do have to pause every time you start to talk.
I know. This is a president who has not put forth an approved budget in 3 years and will be facing sequestration, his own idea, and that's going to hit the military hard.
We've got to go to a commercial. Every time the Republican talks, we've got to go to a commercial. 1-800-723-8289. From coast to coast and border to border, we got a lively discussion. Callers on the line. You'll hear them all when we roll on from the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go back to calls. Let's go to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where Sam is listening to us on WRNN. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, Bruce. I've been listening, and I think it's a statistical impossibility for Barack Obama to win this election. If you look at Gallup and Rasmussen, which are the only two polling companies that do daily tracking based on party affiliation, independents are going for Romney by double digits. And for the first time in the history of this nation, Republican affiliation outnumbers Democrat affiliation.
Well, by the way,
we're going to take a look at those two polls.
I want to take a look at those two polls, and then we'll look at the Gallup poll, and then the Matt Rasmussen poll. But again, and then I want to go inside those numbers. So, Fritz, let's take a look at those polls, and we have likely voters, and that's when you're looking at voters, you should always ask yourself whether or not they're giving you likely voters. The political pros like to look at that. That is the most viable and most reliable of the polls. According to Gallup, Romney is now leading, this is nationally now, 50% to Obama's 46%. The Rasmussen poll, it's Romney 50, it's Obama 47, and there are many liberals and there are many Democrats who believe that, the Rasmussen poll is sort of traditionally a Republican-friendly.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
That I think that is the perception of the Rasmussen poll.
What about the Gallup poll?
Less so, I think. I think it's not considered that way. But I would say that even if it's accurate, who cares if you win the national popular vote, right? We've got a ridiculous way to pick the president in this country, an antiquated, horrible, anachronistic electoral college.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there aren't many polls that show Romney's winning in those states.
But Sam's point is that the independents are shifting and moving towards Romney.
Right. Stephanie? Well, and I think Sam's point is dead on. I mean, when you've got a 13-point, I think is the number I've been hearing, difference in independents, and we all know that it was the independents that made the difference in 2008. Those polls are showing the people that are they're not on the polar registrations. They're not these polls are looking at registered Democrats and registered Republicans. And from those lists, they're looking at likely voters. So they are sort of missing that independent gap. And when you throw in the independents, and I think you're finding more and more people today are calling themselves independents, it's a strong voting block, and 13-point difference in that, that is significant. And that's something that isn't being captured by a lot of these polls.
I think that there are it's fine to focus on Gallup and Rasmussen, and Nate Silver in the New York Times has ripped Gallup up one side and down the other. But right now you've got 9 different national tracking polls that are going on. I'm looking at a couple here. The Reuters poll's got Obama up by 3. The Investor's Business Daily, not exactly a bastion of liberalism, has Obama up by 1. The PPP poll has, which is a Democratic-leaning firm, has Romney up by 1. I think you could say safely that the national vote is as close to tied as you're going to get. The question is the swing states.
In the swing states, and I want to focus on one. I want to talk about Iowa. Because today, there's a question as to whether newspaper endorsements really mean anything. I think they mean anything when they're just so off the wall insofar as their tradition. And today, the Des Moines Register, which is usually – that's where the very first debate in the caucuses usually takes place. It's sponsored by them. They're not only a Democratic paper. They're more of a liberal Democratic paper in Iowa. Today, they endorsed – Mitt Romney for president. And 4 years ago, they endorsed Barack Obama. And they said, in speaking of the president, his record on the economy the past 4 years does not suggest he would lead the direction of the nation must go into the next 4 years. So I'm wondering whether that assessment, in other words, we liked Barack Obama. We gave him a chance. We gave him the economy. The economy hasn't turned down. And you know what? It really is time to give someone else a chance, and we believe there's a competent person that's out there, and it's Mitt Romney. Now, again, this is a liberal Democratic paper. Now, it seems to me that whether you're in Iowa or you're elsewhere around the country, there's a lot of people that gave Obama the chance that really wanted him to succeed, and he has not lived up to their expectations, especially when his campaign style has certainly changed insofar as the negativity of this campaign as opposed to the hope of the last campaign. Right. Does this editorial today, Dan Johnson, would you acknowledge that this may really hit a nerve and may have some reverberation around the country?
Look, it's a nice get for the Romney campaign. There's no question about it. What I think is kind of interesting is it sort of captures what Romney's whole stance was in the debates. Like, hey, you know what? Gas prices are high. Hey, you know what? Unemployment's not taken care of. You know what? Things aren't perfect yet, so cast your vote for me because I'm a businessman. And I think there is sort of that theme out there that, well, that's as far as it goes, so I'm going to vote Republican. And what's interesting to me is it kind of avoids the whole, reality of the V of where we were and that we have turned things around, avoids sort of the whole policy distinguishing features between Romney, which then wants us to go like into a W and back to the same policies that got us in that position. And I find it this sort of like not quite empty, but almost simple-minded, this sort of like man on the street, aw shucks, things aren't perfect, so let's just change it around again.
But again, if you're talking about, I mean, the ultimate decision is one about, it isn't so much about an issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the perception of leadership.
Right.
It's about, and here we are again. This is what their readers are being asked. In a way, it's interesting. We were talking about whether Romney's a flip-flopper or not. The term that the Des Moines Register uses is recalibrated. He's recalibrated his campaign to focus on the concerns of the middle class, and that he is talking, and he is a different person than barnstormed the state during the caucus system. So they've acknowledged the change. They've acknowledged his successful background. But basically, it's about disappointment. It's like, what makes us think that the next 4 years are going to be any different than the last 4 years?
Because you can see the direction.
That's a very hard thing.
You're right.
By the way, on that subject is going to be where we start the next hour of the broadcast, because we are out of time. Our guests will all be back in the second hour. If you are watching us, if you're listening to us on radio, if you're watching us on television, you can only imagine how brilliant they will be in the next hour. But for those who are listening to us on radio, we'll be back shortly. And for the TV folks, we'll see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our second hour of Beyond the Beltway, coming to you from Chicago. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrats Dan Johnson and David Lundy, Republican Stephanie Hitt, Anthony Anderson, and we'll also be hearing from Joe Lenski, who is with Edison Research, and we're going to be talking about polling. Phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. Well, before the break, Dan Johnson was making some points, and you were ready to climb across the table and strangle him.
Well, no, just to, you know, instruct him a little bit. That's all. and that is, you know, what we are seeing is a significant number of newspapers who did endorse Obama back in 2008, had a lot of hope. They were, you know, they felt he brought a fresh dynamic and direction, and they were hopeful for him in 2008. And many of them, non unsurprising, and some of them surprising things. In 2012, today, we're seeing a lot of those newspapers now endorsing Romney. And the message is very simple, and I think it's an important message, even though it is simple. And that, you know, two very important factors. One, this president really has not delivered on any of the promises that he did. There are a few things that he might have done, but each one of them is questionably successful, including even just how he ended the war in Iraq, for example. And then the other thing is, we are still faced today with the most tepid growth, national product growth. We're hovering just trying to reach 2% growth. We've got, you know, more Americans on food stamps. This 5 million jobs, we should be in a recovery that has 9 million jobs.
We can't filibuster now.
Right.
Democrats, Dan, you want to
So I mean, the two things are, you know, he kept almost all of his promises, including to shift our entire foreign policy direction in an incredibly more successful direction, notably, of course, with eliminating almost all of al-Qaeda, including the leadership, pulling us out of the Iraqi war, which was a Republican disaster from the start. And on the economy, you know, I appreciate that people think the stimulus didn't work, but economists and people that study it and do the math say it, in fact, did save or retain 3 million jobs, did, in fact, reduce unemployment by 1%. And I think there's just a clear difference. I mean, obviously,
but
we're not at Clinton.
One of the points that the Des Moines Register in its editorial today referenced was that they said we still are red states and blue states. And Barack Obama, when he was introduced to the American people at the Boston Convention, which propelled him to the presidency, he said that we shouldn't have that. And he was criticized in the editorial because he was going to bring hope and change. He was going to change the climate of Washington. He was going to change the tone of Washington. And it seems to me, and I don't think I'm alone, it seems to me that in as far as partisanship, it's gotten worse in the last 4 years.
I'll acknowledge that partisanship, Barack Obama did not solve partisanship, and the country has become more partisan, less partisan. But blaming Barack for that or thinking that Mitt Romney is going to change that, I think, is absolutely
But what I do blame Obama is this. He's the leader of the free country. I mean, it's up to Barack Obama to bring both sides together. He did not do that. That was one of the things that he said he was going to do. And as a result, we're in a situation we're in today. Today, we have no coherent domestic policy. All you have to do is look at the unemployment rate. All you have to look at the overemployment rate. All you have to look at is the dismal GDP growth. I mean, those are things that could have been addressed with a leader who could bring both sides together. The unemployment
rate that's lower than it's been since Barack Obama was in office when we were losing 800,000. Excuse me, we were losing 800,000 jobs a month when Barack Obama took office. We've created 5.2 million jobs from the low in the middle of 2009.
Jobs.
No, they're not. Nobody wants paying jobs.
David, one second. David, question to you.
Yes.
Would you acknowledge that there is a degree of disappointment amongst many people who voted for Barack Obama 4 years ago?
Absolutely. Of course I would acknowledge that. The truth is, these are very hard times. The other truth is that the Republicans met in Washington on the day of Barack Obama's election, including leadership, including Paul Ryan. 35 of them sat down on his inauguration and said, you know what, we are not going to let this president succeed. It has been well reported. It has been well documented. And then the Tea Party got up and demonstrated that, you know what, if you're an obstructionist, you can win electorally. That is where we are.
Well, let's talk about the first two years. I don't want to look backwards.
I want to try to look to those undecided voters, if they're out there, or those independent voters, and look at the block, because what Barack Obama was able to do, he put together one of the most masterful coalitions. There's about six or seven elements to his coalition. I want to look at one of them, because it was independents. It was moderate Republicans who said 4 years ago that, you know what, we like Barack Obama. We like him personally. I think the fact that he would be the first African-American president was very attractive to them. They wanted to demonstrate that, and they voted. And John McCain was a less than stellar candidate and didn't measure up in a variety of ways, other than notwithstanding his phenomenal military service. He didn't.
Right.
And I don't think he would have been a good president.
Right.
But my point is that those folks now, it's like, okay, we gave this guy a chance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really that happy with him. Why should we give them another chance? That's the core of the Des Moines Register editorial. And then the response is, well, this time we have somebody who's far more competent and a different person than was John McCain. And so the chickens are coming home to roost, to borrow a phrase from the Reverend Wright. The chickens are coming home to roost, and the Republicans and moderates and people who like the idea that Mitt Romney, you know, when Democrats say, oh, he's too moderate, they love that because that's who they are. And I think what's happening here, which hasn't been discussed, it'll be one of the first major things, I think, that will come if indeed Mitt Romney is successful. And that is what we now see, and even what happened at the conventions, we've seen a transformation of the power of the Republican Party. It's back to the moderates. It's back to the Eisenhower wings.
But this is the
of the RNC. I'm talking about the political structure. I'm not talking about Congress. At the moment. So I'm talking about the structure.
You're right to point your finger at these Eisenhower Republicans that abandoned the party under George Bush and are now tempted to go back to Mitt Romney. And I think their problem and the reason why Romney can't quite close the deal is because they don't trust that he will stick to being a moderate when he's elected. That they think, I like what you're saying now, but as soon—
Why wouldn't he? I mean, when he ran for office and he was elected to office, he was running in one of the most liberal liberal states in the United States. He talked like a liberal or talked like a moderate. He governed like a moderate. He is a moderate. Do you think a guy growing up as he was, you know, as the son of a major American automobile, do you think that there's a racist bone in them? Do you think that this guy?
You don't need to be racist, but he embraced. But he embraced. Tell me if you agree with this, Bruce.
Five seconds.
He embraced the hardcore, severely conservative economic philosophy that congressional Republican leaderships totally buy into. He flipped his entire economic position to win that primary.
Yes, and he won the primary, and he may be the next president of the United States because of it. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. We're going to take a little detour of our discussion right now and spend a little time talking about polls. And also, we're going to take a look at what is going to be happening on election night, because the polling that all of the major networks are going to be doing as far as exit polling is going to be different than in previous years. And joining us now is Joe Lenski. He's the executive vice president of Edison Research. That's one of the leading companies in the world that deals with all the major media companies. They conduct surveys, research. I mean, research is in your blood. And Joe, nice to have you back on Beyond the Beltway.
Yes, thanks for having me back.
Before we focus on what's going to happen on election night and how the exit polling is different, I want to get your sense from a professional within the polling field, because there's been quite a bit of discussion, quite a bit of discrepancy and differences between the major polls. So can you give our audience just sort of a primer on how they should react to polls that seem to be significantly different from one another?
Well, I hope your listeners aren't reacting to individual polls. I think you should look at all the polls, get a sense of where they're heading as a group, and not look at individual polls, because individual polls have margins of error. Individual polls have house effects. Individual polls have different methodologies. So I think you want to take them in their totality, not overreact to any individual poll itself.
And should we not, at this particular point, should we not react to a Gallup or a Rasmussen poll, which is a national poll of likely voters? Should we be focusing exclusively on what's happening in the top battleground states?
I think you should be looking at both. I mean, if there's a big national wave that you'll pick up in the national polls, a lot of the close states will end up one way or the other. But if it remains a really close race, which is what the average of the national polls is indicating, then it's going to be the individual states like Ohio and Virginia and Florida and Iowa that we'll be looking at on election night very closely.
Is there any observation that you would like to make? And we should mention that yours is a bipartisan organization. Is there any observation you would like to make on where you see things at this particular moment in the campaign?
Well, I'll tell you just what we're preparing for on election night, and that's for a very, very long election night. I think there's going to be at least five or six really close states, and we're just going to watch the votes be counted in those close states before we make any conclusion. And I that's what we're prepared for.
Now, five or six is a smaller number than the 8 to 9 that some of the networks are identifying. So what would you say are the five or six states that we should be watching?
I'd say the six I'm watching are Ohio, of course, Iowa, Wisconsin, Virginia, Colorado, and then maybe New Hampshire is the sixth.
Have you seen any trend in those six states in the last 2 weeks that can be shared with the audience?
Well, I think the biggest trend we're seeing across the board is that in the early voting, which has increased significantly over the last 12 years, the Obama campaign has really made a big push to get their voters to vote early, either absentee by mail or early voting in person in states that have early voting. I think you're going to see the Republican-Romney campaign kick in that last 72 hours with their get out the vote, and I think it'll be an interesting thing which ends up being bigger, the early vote advantage that Obama's campaign is building up, or the late 72-hour get-out-the-vote-on-election-day push that you're going to see from Romney and his Republican supporters.
Now, at this particular point, obviously, you have competitive news organizations. They're each trying to one-up each other with their polls and how they interpret those polls. And that obviously has led to the debate and the discussion as to whether or not we rely too much on polls. But then there are the professional polls that are being done by the respective campaigns. Can you share with the audience any insight into the difference in methodology that a partisan poll and polling organization might do compared to a Gallup or a Rasmussen or an NBC Wall Street Journal?
Right. The biggest difference in methodology is usually the public polls and the polls done by Gallup and the major national news organizations are done through random digit dialing, a random sample of all phone numbers that they call and try to identify registered voters first and then likely voters through a screen of questions to help predict whether they're going to vote. Partisan polls and campaign polls are used for a different purpose. They're being used as tactical tools, and they want to identify voters, identify messages that will move voters, identify ways to get voters to vote. And they'll usually start with a registered voter list and call off the list of actual registered voters. And that's probably the biggest difference in methodology between the two, but it's also a difference in the purpose of the polls. The partisan campaign polls are used as tactical devices to help move a message, move voters, get voters to vote. The public polls are used to gauge broader public opinion.
Right. And it also serves as a guide as to where they should spend their money and where they should spend the candidate's time. So
exactly.
when you find out where a candidate is spending their day, that means there's a lot of research that has gone into exactly when that happens.
Not only polling research. I mean, you see a lot of mining of data online through other sources, mm-hmm. where they're merging data from consumer sources, credit cards, Google searches, Twitter feeds. There's a whole wealth of data that they're merging in with registered voter lists and targeting people not only through polling information but other information as well.
Joe, I want to go back to a topic that we began our broadcast discussing this evening, and that is the impact of Hurricane Sandy. Again, from your perspective, What are the potential ramifications of Hurricane Sandy as you see it right now?
On the political process, or
yes,
on what we do in terms of doing polls?
If phone lines are down, you're not going to be able to get through to certain people, or they're not going to be taking calls. So
yes, yeah, I think any polling done over the next 48 hours, especially in East Coast states, is going to have even more volatility and more noise than usual. I think you're going to see also the campaigns have already changed their schedules in terms of where they're going and how active they want to appear during this period. And also, early voting is happening in many states. It was supposed to begin in Maryland. It's already been canceled in Maryland tomorrow, so people that were planning to vote early in Maryland won't have that opportunity. So,
I should mention, by the way, we're talking to Joe Lenski. He's Executive Vice President of Edison Research. They currently conduct all the exit polls and election projections for the six major news organizations, ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, NBC, and the Associated Press. It is the Associated Press that gets the primary or the core hard numbers. They share them with everyone else, and then you get into the interpretation of how you're going to conduct the exit polls so they can say that, 20% of white men voted this way, and they get into the demographics of the split. But how is that going to be changed for this coming election night?
Well, I think the changes have been exaggerated. We're doing a lot of what we've done before. I think it's just a concentration on resources, the same way the campaigns are concentrating their resources on the battleground states. The news organizations have increased their sample sizes in the key states and decreased their sample sizes, the number of voters we're going to talk to in the less competitive states. So I think it's more just a reallocation of resources than a major change.
And is your exit poll comes after they have voted?
Correct. We talk to voters after they have voted, after they leave their polling place. We have an interviewer at about 1,000 randomly selected locations around the country. They hand a questionnaire to a voter. The voter fills it out themselves, folds it up, puts it in a little ballot box that we provide our interviewer, and it's a private, confidential, random survey that after a voter votes.
As you're providing all of this information to the respective networks that basically are this consortium that has hired your organization to do this, if they're all looking at the same numbers, they're all going to come up with the same conclusions, are they not?
Well, they all have their own brain trust. They all bring in different statistical analysts, different political analysts. They're looking at key county returns, key precinct returns, key demographic groups, and they may have different analysis. They may come to different conclusions, but they would be looking at the same raw data that everyone.
And from a competitive standpoint, can you describe the pressure that a network goes under to be the first to make a call?
Yes, because before 2003, when Edison took over the consortium in terms of providing exit polls, I was on the other side. I was a decision team consultant for CNN and CBS from 1996 to 2002. So I've been.
When
on
is
that
it safe
side.
Enough? When is it safe enough for them? Or when was it safe enough for you to say, okay, Ohio is going this way or that way?
Well, we have a lot of statistical models, and we build them so that the computer tells us it's safe when there's 99.5% confidence. But for a state like Ohio, we might wait till even more confidence than that, because even a 1 in 200 chance of being wrong is probably too high a chance for the state that's probably going to decide who's.
Joe, can you stick with us a little bit longer
sure.
and do another segment? We're going to go to
sure.
a break here. Our guest is Joe Lenski. He is the Executive Vice President of Edison Research. He really is a walking, talking encyclopedia of polling history. And again, he is advising all of the major networks on their exit polling. And again, after all this discussion about whether polls are right or wrong, obviously on election night, you're going to be flipping along the dial on radio, television, internet, everywhere to find out who's going to give you the first tweet as to who's winning in a particular state. Joe Lenski is going to be a key cog in that decision-making process for the networks. He continues with us along with our guests in Chicago and your calls, 1-800-723-8289. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us around the table this evening. Our Democrats are Dan Johnson and also David Lundy. Our Republicans are Stephanie Hitt and Anthony Anderson. And joining us on the phone is Joe Lenski. He is the Executive Vice President of Edison Research, who in the last segment identified that really there are now six states that his organization is really focusing on. So the battleground's down to six states: New Hampshire, Colorado, Virginia, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Ohio. And I think it's interesting that you have in that state, you have Iowa and you have New Hampshire, where this entire process started, that still those two states that have had probably more of a heavy dose of politics than any two of our 50 states, at the very end, they're still undecided.
They're so greedy. They get all the attention.
They want lots of
money. I'm jealous, personally.
Joe, we have people around the table. They do have questions for you. And Dan Johnson, who is very involved in election law here in Illinois, in addition to being a former student of Barack Obama's in law school, is with us tonight. He's got a question for you.
Just very briefly, you know, I've always been intrigued on exit polls, how logistically they work. So that it's interesting that it's done on paper and put in a ballot box. Are they kind of understood to be sort of part of the process, meaning you get a little bit more access to the polling place than other people would? Or are you waiting outside? How does it logistically work?
Yeah, in most cases, our interviewer is placed right outside the polling place. Different states have different regulations, but it's usually right outside the door of the polling place. We work with county and state election officials, so they know beforehand where our interviewers will be, so that the local election officials know we're not trying to disrupt the process. If anything, we don't even enter the process until the voter is actually voted.
And is that particular interview, is that like automatically fed back, or do they interview 10 or 15 or 20 people and then phone in the information or bring the information back?
Our interviewers will complete at least 100 interviews at each location, and they have a schedule for 3 times during the election day to call in those results.
And are they looking for specific people? In other words, do they take the first 100 people that will speak to them, or are they looking for a percentage of women, a percentage for African Americans, and are they demographically selective?
This is a completely random process. We pick the sample of locations based on a random process that gives us representation geographically for each state, politically for each state, make sure there's enough precincts with blacks and Hispanics. But once we're at the precinct, it's a random selection of voters at each precinct. We
Stephanie,
approach every
Hitt,
third or every fourth voter in a random pattern. There's no quota sampling at all.
Stephanie Hitt's got a question for you.
Yeah, I have a question. I know, you know, this election we're looking at early voting, and absentee voting is probably some of the highest it's ever been. So I'm curious, one, how percentage-wise is, you know, not just nationally, but in those, you know, battleground states where it does exist, what are we looking percentage-wise in terms of how much of the vote cast is early voting and absentee versus how much is going to be done on election day? And then the other question I have is...
let's let him answer that one first.
And then, well, absentee votes.
Okay.
Could this affect...
Well, early voting has been increasing since 2000 very dramatically. Back in 2000, it was only about 16% of vote was cast before election day. By 2004, it was up to 24%. In 2008, it was 32%, and it may indeed be higher this year, especially in the states where the campaigns are concentrating their resources. Again, it varies from state to state. Oregon and Washington are now completely by mail voting, and 100% of the vote is by mail. Of the key battleground states, Nevada will be well over 60% cast early. Estimates now in Iowa and Ohio are that 30 to 40% of the vote will be cast before Election Day in those states.
And do you have a process for polling early voting, since, you know, yes, a lot of the exit polls will be on Election Day, you know, grabbing people? Do you have some sort of read on the early voting?
Yes, we conduct the week before Election Day telephone interviews of people who have told us they have already voted early, and we ask them the same questions that we're going to ask voters on Election Day, and we, in each state, we merge those results together in the proportion of early vote to Election Day vote.
Joe, I said earlier in the broadcast that early voting could either be Republicans or Democrats, but that historically absentee voting tended to be more of a Republican-skewed procedure. Is that accurate?
Historically, Republicans have been more likely to take advantage of voting by mail before Election Day, and Democrats have usually stressed voting in person before Election Day, especially in states like Florida. You'll see differences between the by mail voting and the early voting by party. I think those differences are eroding over time as both parties realize, you know, an absentee vote or an early vote is a vote in the bank, a vote you can count on before Election Day, and you don't have to worry about, God forbid, a hurricane hitting on Election Day or a blizzard that lowers your turnout on Election Day. If you have someone already put that vote in the bank, you know that's going to be counted.
Now, once upon a time, this being maybe within the last 8 years, a pollster friend of mine said that the best barometer, if you want to know who is going to win, watch what happens in New Mexico. And because he said New Mexico had the best record of selecting presidents. Is that still accurate, or has that changed?
I think the fact that neither candidate has been to New Mexico in months shows that that's no longer the case. And a lot of states like New Mexico, like California, like Nevada, as the increase in Hispanic voting has gone predominantly Democratic, those swing states have drifted more to the Democratic Party.
What about the other point that this person said to me was that if you go to the San Fernando Valley, literally the valley in California, that is the sort of the microcosm of the United States. Could you offer any assessment in that area?
That might be demographically, but again, California is a state that either candidate will go to except to raise a lot of money in the rich areas of California. So even though that might be demographically a microcosm, it's getting no attention at all from either of these candidates.
All right, since we've crossed off the two things that used to be a barometer, well, that's good. I want to be educated here as well. Is there a place or is there a county on election night? Where is Joe Lenski going to be looking first? What are you going to be looking at? What counties or states or regions of states will you have your eyes on?
Bill Weathers?
Well, to me, the three key states are Virginia, Ohio, and Iowa. In just about any plan to put together 270 electoral votes for either Barack Obama or Mitt Romney, they probably need two of those three states to get to 270 electoral votes. And there are a handful of key counties in all three of those states that voted for George W. Bush in 2004 and voted for Barack Obama in 2008. And those would probably be what I'd be paying the most attention to.
All right. Well, I would just say, because I don't know if you heard the earlier segment, we spent some time talking about the Des Moines Register support of Mitt Romney, endorsement of Mitt Romney. It seemed to me that if you, with your great expertise, have identified Iowa as one of the big three of the big six, it seems to me that an endorsement from the major newspaper in the state, at least one that's historic and that they normally don't do Republicans, that endorsement could have some significant sway.
It may, but it was interesting to me that endorsement happened after about 200,000 to 300,000 Iowans have already voted.
Yeah.
So a lot of vote has been cast in Iowa of voters that did not read that editorial before.
Dave Lundy is here. He is a Democrat, and he's got a question for you.
In 2004, the early exits, and this happened again in 2008, the early exits were notoriously off. In fact, the Democrats in 2004 got giddy because the early reports from the exit polls were that John Kerry was cleaning the clock of George W. Bush in Ohio, and obviously that turned out not to be the case. In 2012, at what point do you integrate all of your data together, including the early voting and absentee voting data, into your model? Does that happen throughout the day, or does that not happen until the end of the day?
It happens throughout the day, but it's a process like any survey. You're interviewing people throughout the day, and an exit poll is unique in that people are looking at this data before the survey is even complete. You know, Gallup rarely will put out any results before all their interviews are done. Any other survey organization will complete all their interviews before releasing the data. We have clients that want to see this data updated during the day. Now, we've put in place some security measures since 2004. We call it a quarantine room in which our clients get to see this data, but the group that's in that room gives up their cell phones, gives up their internet access. They only can look at this data. They can't communicate to anyone outside that room until after 5 o'clock. So unlike 2004, you won't see any exit poll data even talked about or tweeted about or leaked to the internet until after the quarantine period ends at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm-hmm.
Joe, where are you going to be on election night?
Hopefully, as long as we have electrical power, I will be in lovely Somerville, New Jersey, which is our headquarters here.
And how many people will be surrounding you?
We'll have a couple dozen people here, but all told on Election Day, Edison Research will hire almost 3,000 people to work for us for one day.
Well, Joe, well, listen, we are out of time for our segment, but I want to volunteer that if you need someone to be there and observe what you're doing on Election Night, I'd be delighted to join you.
Okay.
But will you put the chip in your
brain? I will turn off my cell phone. But that would be nice to be. Wouldn't it be nice to follow Joe Lenski around
cool.
on election night?
Cool.
So, yeah. Joe, again, thanks very much. Joe Lenski is Executive Vice President of Edison Research. As you can hear from the last half hour of conversation, a man who's inside knowledge of the polling in the country is spectacular. Thanks very much. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We're going to go to calls in just a moment. But, Dave, you wanted to put a couple of things on the record that we were talking about. One of the things, the thing that you said literally right before it went on the air, that if Obama gets reelected, he is likely to be
the first president reelected with fewer votes and fewer electoral votes than he had, I believe, in this century. I don't know about the 19th
century. That's a small century.
The 20th century, not the 21st century. Sorry. My head's still in the 20th. But the other thing is that we will make history one way or another on Election Day, because if Mitt Romney is elected, it will be the first time that somebody who had an upside-down approval rating in September went on to win for president. Yeah. That's never happened. So one way or another, we're making history. And I think that
as well as if Obama gets elected, it's the first time that someone has been elected where people were not voting their pocketbook? Would you say that's a fair assessment?
I don't think that's a fair assessment, because I think that it depends on how you define that. Again, if you look at the trends, unemployment, consumer confidence, there was just a study, there was just a report that came out on Friday, the Gallup poll nobody talked about, which said that people are more optimistic about their economic situation now than they have been in 4 years. And that's the first time that's happened.
Yes, but that standard is so low and it's so minimal. And people keep talking about these upward trends. We are talking about the most spittling tiny of upward trends. Most people are stepping back and going, yeah, maybe things are sort of bursting through here and there. But where we should be at this point and where we should have been and what we were promised, it's not even close.
But that's not the question.
But I think that there's some optimism because they know that there's an end. Next week, yes. Tuesday, we'll know either way the direction of the country. And I think that's more bringing more optimism than anything else in this country.
Well, we're going to also have jobs numbers
that are coming out. They're expecting about 1.25.
I mean,
everybody's ready to spin that either way.
That's
those press releases are already written.
Well below July. Right.
Well, I'll spin it counter, Bruce, to what you would expect.
Okay.
I will tell you right here that if that number starts with an 8, Mitt Romney will be the next president, and it's going to depress the heck out of me. But I think that there are so many of these states are coming down to just a few voters, that the undecided voters are not all uninformed. Many of them are informed, and they're looking for just something to push them over the edge. And an unemployment rate that's back up to 8, I think that would do it.
And you were talking about, again during the break, you were talking about a story that you just read that's about analysis of the battleground states.
Yeah, the AP story is focusing on the fact that Mitt Romney hasn't been in positive territory in any of the polls coming out of Ohio, and that fundamentally they can't win without Ohio. And AP is saying, therefore, Obama has effectively beaten back Romney's momentum coming out of the debates. Again, there's one poll today in Ohio that shows them tied. There's four polls that show Obama up by either 2, 3, or 4 points. You know, look, I don't know what all of this means, and I don't think any of us do, because on Election Day, plus you throw in the October surprise of Hurricane Sandy, we could all be in for a big surprise.
Well, we've also just heard from Joe. I mean, he has reduced the number of battleground states to 6.
Yeah.
Which I think
and
is
down to 3: Iowa, yeah. Ohio,
Ohio,
and Virginia.
Ohio and Virginia. Said, yeah. Those
and so
three.
I go back to Iowa, but also by putting the other stories that have come out a couple of times this week, primarily Republican related or source, and that is that Romney can win without Ohio. That's the new thing. There's a way in which they can do it. So if you put Wisconsin, which means they'd be spending more time in Wisconsin and Iowa.
But, the other thing I think
I think the fact that this – again, I don't mean to overplay this Des Moines Register thing, because I think generally newspaper endorsements aren't what they used to be. But when you are the dominant paper in a state and you have routinely gone one way – and they're not just Democratic, they're liberal Democratic – that is a big, big story in a swing state.
But do you think that is the mindset of those 300,000 individuals that have already voted?
No, the point was those people, they've already voted. They didn't wait for this. I'm just saying, I can't believe.
Do you think they have the same mindset?
I cannot believe at this moment in time, given the influence of the newspaper in the state, I cannot believe that the influence of the Des Moines Register will not be significant enough to flip that state.
But, Bruce,
saying that's a bold statement. You just
I made three tonight. Yeah. The first one you caught.
And I'm willing to acknowledge. You just called Iowa for Romney. You just called it.
I did.
Well, let me tell you, here's the problem, I think. This is why I think he's gonna, he can't close in Ohio or Iowa. Maybe Virginia. Romney can't.
Okay.
He's got a John Kerry problem. He's too rich. He can't connect with people, especially because his whole career
has been, and you're right.
Because his whole career has been built off of rich finance people taking the money out of the pockets of middle class.
That doesn't play in Iowa.
Here's the thing that's very clear.
The Priorities USA Super PAC ad, that is all about, you know what? I work in a factory in Marion, Indiana. I created a stage, and I built that stage so that all these rich bankers from Bain Capital come in here and say, I lost my job. And our factory was profitable, and now it's shut down.
So the guy's saying, I built it. He said
he did. He did. That was his last job.
Well, and I just want to say this.
What the Des Moines Register and, you know, major newspapers in Florida and Ohio, when they're coming out and endorsing Romney, they're reflecting something. And one of the things that we're reflecting is this feeling that, you know, Romney, it's not this portrayal of Romney as disconnected and rich or whatever, that people have learned and they've gotten it, that he understands. He understands the problems. He understands the solutions. He's proven that record. And that's what's really important, is that we are seeing softening in Obama hardcore states like Michigan and Pennsylvania. I'm not going to give
them. Dave's got numbers. Dave's got numbers.
It shows the trend is that way.
If you give Romney Florida, Virginia, North Carolina, New Hampshire, Iowa, and Colorado, Barack Obama's reelected with 271 electoral votes. Unless he wins Ohio, it is almost impossible for him to win.
Ladies and gentlemen, just think about it as you go to bed tonight. There could be another tie. There could be another tie. If you like 2000, maybe it's going to happen again. Or it certainly, it appears to be that the likelihood of, or not the likelihood, but the growing possibility of someone winning the popular vote and a different person winning the electoral vote, that's more viable today than the past. Anyway, on that note, we are out of time. To all of our guests, thank you very much. Dan Johnson and David Lundy and Stephanie Hitt and Anthony Anderson. This program is a Gen B production. Our thanks to Dan Dorfman and Tom Veracruz. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.